heard on great radio stations all across America. It's The National Defense with Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry.
This is The National Defense. Randy Miller along with Jerry Newberry, Communications Director for the VFW. And man, your arms have got to be tired. Just back from D.C.
Yeah, busy week.
Very busy.
Washington conference, and we had a great opportunity to sit down and interview some high-power people. Yeah.
Okay, before we get to it, the dedication as always.
Hey, we do this show for you, the men and women serving on active duty, the Guard and Reserves, all the veterans out there, and all the families. God bless you.
Hey, Jerry, got a brand new affiliate this week. Toledo is checking in, the patriotic talk station there, Super Talk 1560. Thank you so much, and we are proud to be in Toledo with the National Defense. All right, Jerry, who you got? You got, you know, admirals, you got current, who are we talking to?
Yeah, we were able to sit down with Secretary of the VA, James Peake, who recently just assumed the
good, I want to hear office. That.
Yeah, we put some, I thought, pretty tough questions to him. A good friend of ours, Army Surgeon General, Lieutenant General Eric Schoomaker, great guy.
Great.
And then, of course, we have Rear Admiral Busby, Commander Joint Task Force Guantanamo.
Wow.
So that was all interesting interviews.
That's some heavy hitters. That is all coming up this hour on the National Defense.
With us today is Secretary of the VA, James Peake. Mr. Secretary, what I'd like to do today is, first of all, give our listeners a sense of who you are. You served as a grunt in Vietnam, combat wounded, and I understand while you're recuperating from your wounds, you received word you were accepted in medical school. Went from that to the top physician, top Army physician, and now Secretary of the VA. And I'm not giving you special treatment because we're both screaming eagles.
But,
okay. All right, so you went from a combat wounded infantryman, a grunt, to the Army's top doc. Now you're leading the second largest department in the government, a proposed $94 billion budget, almost a quarter million employees. How'd your military experience prepare you for the task at hand?
Well, I guess I would say in a couple of ways. One, it gave me a sense of the mission because I understand the folks that we are who are entrusted to our care and to our responsibility. The other is that I've had the privilege of being a general officer for 12 years and commanding progressively larger organizations. And what you start to learn and understand as you move up in that kind of an environment is that you really have to have good people and trust them and empower them and give them good guidance. And they'll understand intent and move forward. So I feel comfortable, particularly when I see the quality of the people in the VA that I have a chance to interface with daily.
Do you think sometimes employees of the VA get a bad shake? People are too critical at times with so many people who are doing so much for our veterans?
Well, I think you have 254,000 people out there. The vast majority are trying to do the right thing every single day. And every now and then something doesn't go right, and just by the nature of things, the whole organizations will sometimes get colored by that, which is not fair, and it's not characteristic of the organization. But anytime something goes wrong, we have a responsibility and an obligation to deal with it, and we do. And I'm proud of the way the organization does that. And the people need to understand that I used to talk about America's Army. Well, we're America's VA, and there's no organization that is more transparent than we, and that's what we owe the American people.
You retired from the Army 3 years before the Walter Reed outpatient debacle. What would you have done different? Would you have done anything different to prepare the Army medical community for the influx of casualties, of patients, because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think hindsight's always 2020.
Yeah.
And so, I know that there were good people around doing good things. And but it, again, it's sort of the, as I talked about before, when something's, you find something wrong, something didn't happen the way it should, you've got to deal with it acutely and you've got to and correct it. I mean, just reading the recent reports, my sense is the Army has done tremendous turn in taking care of the outpatient population and understanding their needs. You know, it's a volunteer Army. People have come into the Army and want to complete their tours. You go out and you see these young men and women that they really want to do that. And that's why I am so excited about the opportunity to work with the Army and the Navy and the Air Force to work on this seamless transition piece. It's about getting it right for them.
Well, I do have a question about seamless transition.
Sure.
And that's a high priority of the VFW.
Mm-hmm.
Having one medical evaluation was a huge step forward. But the electronic medical records, I believe Congress, in fact, voted to make sure that would happen. That's imperative. But DOD, I think, is probably still years away from having an electronic capability that makes for easy communication between the three military services. Is there any progress being made on that?
Well, I think there is, actually. Excuse me. There is progress being made. In fact, ALTA, which is the military system, covers all three services. It's an outpatient record, basically. That is with a data center that has a common data center. So I think that there is great opportunity for moving forward. There's a report coming out in March that I'm anxious to see that hopefully will give me some a lot better idea about what the potentials are in terms of moving forward. The VA has, I think, the best electronic health record probably in the world on the scale that it's got it. But we've got some challenges, too, because we've got to migrate that to a web-based environment. That gives us the opportunity to really work with the DOD to get this right. And so we're already sharing a lot of information. It is not as easy and smooth as any of us would like to see it, but I think we've got the right axis of advance on it, and we will be making some progress here.
Well, that's good to hear. During your confirmation hearing, now, I had the distinct impression that what the senators most wanted to hear from you, they wanted you to be honest with them about what your department needs to accomplish its mission. How are you going to work with Congress to make sure that politics doesn't get in the way with taking care of our nation's veterans?
Well, I believe that it is imperative. Part of my job is to work closely with Congress. And I'm also the advocate for veterans. So my whole focus here is to try to get it right for the future. Looking down the line, the transition is an important piece. The issue of PTSD and TBI is an important piece that has near-term and longer-term implications. The issue of the claims backlog, if you will, is an important piece. And then the IT support that cross-cuts all of those are important aspects to be able to do those things. I think what I found was Congress is very interested in all of those and wants to get it right. And just as the BSOs, I think, feel that same need. So, part of my responsibility as a public servant here is to work with Congress, to work with the BSOs, the stakeholders, and to try to move us in the right direction.
You mentioned backlogs a second ago. There's no doubt that VA provides world-class health care. Not going to get any argument from us on that, that's for sure. But your benefits administration really hasn't pulled its own weight. Last month, the VA's own Monday morning report had almost 890,000 backlog compensation, pension, and education claims or appeals. That's 29,000 higher than the previous year. You know, certainly reducing the backlog is priority for the VFW. What are you going to do to focus more attention without sacrificing the rating decisions, quality rating decisions, and this ever-growing problem that's, you know, a lot of people consider it out of control?
Well, I think there's several pieces to it. First of all, there's been a 51—by 2009, we expect there'll be a 51% increase from about 2000 in terms of claim. So, and what we've been able to do is kind of keep the inventory stable. So, I mean, our production's up about 12%. We've hired about 1,800 new folks since January 2007. We'll hire a total of 3,100 new ones and train them. That's one piece of it. I mean, that's what you can do with that kind of a problem in the short term. And I agree with you that 182 days on average is too long. We want to get it down to 169 days to complete this year, 145 days in 2009. But what I, you know, it is still largely a paper process. We have two places with the benefits delivery at discharge where we're doing it on average of 85 days because we're getting the information and we're doing it electronically. So. In terms of a paperless process.
That goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
Absolutely. We got to get ourselves into the modern era here. The other thing is the complexity of the disability system, and I know that there's some controversy about how we would restructure that, but, you know, smart people got to be able to come together and figure out what is right for the 21st century, not just how do we tweak what was good maybe in the, right. you know, 40 In 1956, in the Bradley Report, they were pushing to take a good hard look at it back then even. So, you know, I think it's time now. We've had so many people looking at it. We can come together and figure out what the right road ahead is here to get a more simplified, streamlined disability system that can be where you can use rules-based engines and where you can be fair to everybody as we move forward.
Is part of that in... I'm not quite sure if this plays into it or not, but the Dole Shillelagh
absolutely
condition,
does.
I know the VFW's in agreement with five of the six recommendations, but the recommendation that we just draw a line in the sand, we most adamantly oppose, is the one that would compensate veterans with similar injuries differently.
I think veterans with similar injuries are at different stages of their lives. I guess my point is we ought to be looking at all the options and to say, okay, what really is the right thing here as we move forward? So somewhere you got to be able to shift if we're going to restructure the system.
That would be considered part of the streamlining process? So you think a different rating schedule is fair?
I think we need to lay it out so that people know what they're talking about. You know, and that's why I'm anxious to get these studies together and be able to present something, you know, but I want to get the best ideas and the best advice to do it.
Okay. The Veterans Disability Benefits Commission spent almost 3 years analyzing the problem and made recommendations to improve the current compensation program without destroying the features that's made it work so well for so many years. Mm-hmm. What's the VA doing to implement the recommendation?
Well, we're absolutely taking a look at all of those recommendations. There are 113 of them that need to be analyzed, and going through them to see how that would fit and reshape as we move forward to restructuring the disability system. I mean, there in many ways, some of the things that they talked about, like quality of life, were things that Dole Shillelagh talked about. In fact, they testified for Dole Shillelagh. So, you know, part of it is making sure that we get, you know, Dole Shillelagh gives us an access advance and a blueprint to move forward. And I think we
so
really
it's not
should
gospel,
take a look at
it's something to work.
Well, it's
build
sure
upon.
The details have to be worked out.
Right.
Because what we want to do is get it right.
Well, Mr. Secretary, we appreciate your time, and we really do.
Well, I appreciate the chance to.
You have a lot of challenges.
Yeah. I do, but I, you know, it's a great opportunity to do something that's worthwhile, was talking to Dr. Cussman the other day about, I mean, sometimes, you know, they're long days, and and he was saying the same thing about how nice it is to be able to feel like you're part of something that is really worthwhile. And so I'm delighted to have this job.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, you've certainly served our country well and in the past, and I'm sure you'll serve our nation's veterans well also. Thank
you.
I'll
just do my best. Thanks.
Right. We're standing guard with the truth, the national defense.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The Veterans of Foreign Wars believes in active allegiance to flag and country. Through legislative activism and service to our military forces, veterans, their families, and communities. Freedom starts at home. Pledge your allegiance again. If you're a veteran and served overseas, you may be eligible to become a member of the nation's elite veterans organization, the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
You've served your country, now you can help your country serve others. Call 1-888-JOIN-VFW. That's 1-888-JOIN-VFW.
Big Brothers Big Sisters presents 100 Years of Helping Kids.
With us today are Sally and her big sister Marcy.
Hi.
Hello. To share some stuff we've learned.
Kids and sugar, a combustible mix.
Hey Marcy, let's go to the zoo.
Maybe the park.
We could fly a kite.
I want a hot dog.
No.
Ice cream.
Is that a horse?
I love horses.
Hey, let's dance.
Maybe that's enough chocolate.
And sing.
La la la. La 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 la.
It's also not uncommon for a kid to demonstrate special powers.
Did you know I can run through walls?
No.
Watch this.
Oh, Sally.
Don't worry. I also have amazing healing powers.
Moments like these happen every day.
Making a big difference in the life of a child. To find out the many ways you can help support kids in your community, call 1-888-412-BIGS or go to BigBrothersBigSisters.org.
That's BigBrothersBigSisters.org.
This message brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
That's all for now.
Test.
Right, you're listening to the National Defense. With us today is Army Surgeon General, Lieutenant General Eric Schoomaker. How are you, General?
I'm well. Thank you, Jerry. I appreciate being back on your program again. And I want to say right up front how much I appreciated the opportunity to speak with you last year. This is a little more comfortable environment
than
we had last
right.
year.
Yeah, you went out of your way last time to do the interview, and we appreciate it.
Well, you did too, and we appreciate that.
Last time you were on the program, the Warrior Transition Units were just being formed.
Yes, sir.
And that was because of the investigations, the revelations. And they were just being formed. You were trying to put the cadre together to form those units. What kind of progress had been made with the WTUs?
I think remarkable progress. The Warrior Transition Units and the Marines, by the way, have a comparable system around a wounded warrior regiment. Although, admittedly, we've got a larger number of soldiers in our Warrior Transition Units now. These units, in less than a year, with robust support and guidance of the Vice Chief Staff of the Army, Dick Cody, with oversight by the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Casey, and the Secretary himself, Pete Guerin, have been now rendered fully operationally capable. In less than a year, we, despite not working within the normal rotation cycle of the Army, because we were working after the summer, this order really went out in June of last year. We've now almost fully staffed all 35 Warrior Transition Units across the Army, over 2,400 soldiers. These are infantrymen, artillerymen, many of them combat veterans, are coming back and being assigned to these units to provide the squad leaders, the platoon sergeants, the company commanders, the battalion commanders that we require.
And the big improvement for our listeners and also from my own memory, the Warrior Transition Units, for example, at one time prior to those units, patient might be grouped in with 50 or 60 other patients, and paperwork could get lost and things that. And now with these warrior transition units, that cuts it down to you have a squad leader. So it's
just like any other unit in the Army. It's just like any other unit in the Army. You're absolutely right. Your memory is great. In fact, we really build this around a three-legged stool, a triad, if you will, a three-member team, a squad leader, just like any other small unit in the Army, who has then platoon sergeants and a company commander above him or her, a nurse case manager who watches over the administrative coordination as a soldier goes through the process of healing and then full recovery and rehabilitation, helps coordinate their appointments, tracks family problems and the like, and then a primary care physician who has the responsibility for the medical care to kind of bring together in a comprehensive way oversight over what this soldier is going through to get fully recovered and rehabilitated. That team is responsible for developing a comprehensive care plan that from the beginning puts the warrior in transition, as we now call these wounded, ill, and injured soldiers, on a path toward full recovery and rehabilitation, and then return to your uniform, which occurs in over three-quarters of the time, or two-thirds to three-quarters of the time, or back into civilian life with a new vocational direction, if necessary, and a new training, or into the Veterans Administration system, or into private rehabilitative medicine if they continue to have medical or surgical problems or psychiatric problems that we need to address. So that triad is really the small unit key team that we look to.
So nobody gets lost.
Well, that's our intent. Yeah, right. But your organization is one of those organizations that helps us ensure that they don't get lost. Frankly, one of the things we learned from the Walter Reed experience, which I have to tell you was not restricted to Walter Reed alone. It was across the Army. It was across the Joint Force and to some degree. What we learned from that is that we needed a much better way of measuring whether we were doing right by our folks, by our families and our soldiers. Those reserve soldiers who are leaving uniform and going back out into private life, they're in parts of the country that don't have a large medical facility sometimes close by. And so we need the ability to measure and to tap into where frustrations, where problems exist. And we have now over 18 different methods for doing that, including a 1-800 line that we give to any soldier and his or her family and encourage them to call if they're having any difficulty.
That's the Wounded Warrior Hotline?
Yes, sir. It's the Wounded Soldier and Family Hotline. Can I give it?
Oh, absolutely.
It's 1-800-984-8523. 1-800-984-8523. And what we ask is if you have any problems with care, with pay, with housing, as a warrior in transition, or within any of our community-based health corps organizations, we call them CBHCOs across the country, that you call that number, and within 24 hours, we'll get back to you with a plan for how we can solve your problem.
And again, that's a 24-hour hotline.
24/7, right. Days a week, 365 days a year.
We've sort of tracked that hotline. We've kind of kept an eyeball on it.
Good.
And, from the time it started until last month, you're getting tremendous amount of calls, so it's obviously doing a lot of good.
It is. We're the other thing we do is try not just to solve that problem, but to look at trends and say, well, you know, is there an issue here that we need to address with policy, or is our organization need to be adjusted? Where can they be? Another very important feature of our efforts over the last year, and this is something members of Congress were particularly interested in our doing, was to set up a system of ombudsmen who could work outside of the chain of command. They're objective observers to whom and problem solvers to whom a soldier or his or her family could go if they had problems of any kind. And they have direct access to the commander of our hospital, to the commanders of our warrior transition units, to the installation senior mission commander, to the garrison commander, the mayors, if you will, of our posts, and help solve problems. And those ombudsmen, many of whom are former NCOs or officers, a good deal of them have experience in the medical system, are there and are being trained and hired and trained and are doing a superb job for us. Everybody knows who the ombudsman is in our camps, posts, and stations and in our warrior transition units, and I encourage folks to go to those folks as well.
A couple of things we read about, hear a lot about on TV, traumatic brain injury, and suicides.
Yes, sir.
Can you speak about that? What's being done to address those
issues? First of all, let me make a point, if I might. You often hear people talk about the signature injury of this war, and what I'm concerned about is that we not pay short shrift to any injury that results from this war. I will tell you, I believe that there is a signature weapon of this war, and it's blast. Our enemy is using it very effectively and adaptively, and we're looking at all times to counter its effects. I know that blast takes limbs and results in amputees. It takes eyesight. It takes hearing. It also causes concussive injury, all the way up to severe injuries from penetrating head wounds. And those concussive injuries, and then as a consequence of the horrors of combat and the challenges that our soldiers experience, we have post-traumatic stress. This is what our leadership has called the human dimension of war, which has been with us since the beginning of warfare.
Right.
But we now recognize and are putting our arms around and working very hard as an army to reduce the stigma associated with seeking help for those expected stresses that our soldiers and their families may experience. What we are observing is that with proper screening, with the reduction in stigma, with providing resources to help our people, that we expect fully that those with symptoms that are found early will fully recover from those symptoms. Again, this is a normal human reaction to a very difficult experience in life. What we want to prevent is that those post-traumatic stress symptoms don't become hardened and become a permanent disorder, a post-traumatic stress disorder, especially if it's complicated by drugs or alcohol or family discord or violence. Exactly.
Right.
Suicide is also a focus of ours. We have seen an upward trend in our suicide statistics. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we had adjusted for the demographics of the Army and the rest of the country. We were about half the rate of suicide of the rest of the country, and we're asking ourselves now, what has happened that we're beginning to drift up toward the rate of the country at large? And right now, the Army Chief of Personnel, the G1, has got a task force of general officers, myself included, in support, looking at what we need to do to reverse that trend.
During your remarks earlier, VFW, you repeatedly used the word care. And just from our discussion this morning, I think that certainly applies when it comes to the Army, TBI, suicides, the warrior transition units. It's amazing. You know, when you think of the Army, it's an awfully big organization, and armies usually move very slowly. But I think the Army has responded just in a great way to the needs of our soldiers and our families.
Well, that means a lot coming from you. I appreciate that. It's very heartening to hear you say that. You know, as a former chief of ours said, soldiers aren't in the Army. Soldiers are the Army. Soldiers are the Army. And for many of us, myself included, this is a deeply personal venture. I mean, my father was a career soldier for over 30 years in uniform. My brother was a career soldier with over 30 years in uniform. I have a niece in uniform today who's fighting in defense of the country. I have a nephew who's in the Air Force piloting a an aircraft that maybe someday I'll be able to fly in the back of. This is a deeply personal challenge to many of us, and we want to keep our soldiers and our families strong, and so care is at the center of that, Jerry.
That's good to hear. General, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
The only truth you'll hear on the radio, the National Defense.
The following letter was written by Technical Sergeant Jerry G., U.S. Air Force.
I've just finished reading over some of the correspondence you've sent us over here. And for an old dog like me, I was choked up. Thanks to each and every one of you. You're the reason why I have proudly put on the uniform of the American forces, to serve folks like you, those we all love and honor, and those who do not have what we have, but who are willing to stand next to us and fight for their own freedom as well. So the next time you see one of my brothers or sisters in arms, shake their hands or pat them on the back. Tell them you support them. This is what we cherish more than anything.
Your support may be the most important thing our troops can carry with them. But don't take our word for it. Take theirs. To show your support, visit americasupportsyou.mil. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Defense and the Ad Council.
Big Brothers Big Sisters presents 100 Years of Helping Kids.
Today, Kyle and his big brother Justin,
hello,
hi,
are here to share some stuff we've learned.
With kids, it's not always what you say, but how you say it.
Hey Kyle, you want to go to a foreign film festival?
Nah, that's boring.
Okay.
Hey Kyle, you want to go to a foreign film festival?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
From time to time, a kid may double dare you.
Wow, that looks heavy. Bet you can't lift it.
Are you serious?
I double dare you.
Okay.
See? I told you. Uh-oh.
Moments like these happen every day.
Making a big difference in the life of a child. To find out the many ways you can help support kids in your community, call 1-888-412-BIGS or go to bigbrothersbigsisters.org.
That's bigbrothersbigsisters.org.
This message brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Until next time.
You're listening to the National Defense, and with us today is Rear Admiral Mark H. Busby, Commander, Joint Task Force, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. How are you, Admiral?
I'm great. Good to be with you this afternoon.
Hey, thanks for being with us. Guantanamo Bay has been in the news for many years now. You know, Admiral, some of the people, unfortunately, in America, and I suppose it's because of the media, have the wrong impression of the mission at Guantanamo. There's been a lot of news about mistreatment of detainees. Can you help clear some of that up for us?
I'd love to, and thank you for the opportunity. It really amazes me, and I think amazes most everyone who actually comes to Guantanamo and sees the fantastic job that our soldiers, sailors, airmen, marine, Coast Guardsmen, and civilians are doing down there. They almost inevitably they'll say it's so different than what I was led to believe. And that goes from the media that come down there all the way up through members of Congress. They're all amazed how misreported it has been over the years.
Well, that's the amazing thing. It's not like Guantanamo has been off limits.
Exactly. We pride ourselves in being transparent. I have media that come down every single week to tour the facilities, and they go on the same tour that I take congressmen on. You know, we don't have anything to hide. Within our limits of classification, they all get to see the same. Facility, they get to see the Guard Force doing their fantastic job day in and day out, and they see the facility and the conditions under which the detainees are maintained, and it's amazing. It's better than anything you're going to find, in an American prison, quite frankly.
And in spite of what some detractors will say and have said and continue, and I'm sure will continue to do so in the future, Guantanamo Bay has played an important role in securing the United States, our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, correct?
Absolutely, and we'll probably never really know how significant a role it played. We know that it has taken some very, very dangerous people off the battlefield, people that have demonstrated a propensity to some pretty significant violence, Those people, while they're at Guantanamo, are not engaged in that activity. They're off the battlefield. That plus the intelligence value that we have derived from these people, and many of them are pretty forthcoming. They're happy to tell us, almost out of arrogance, what they've done and how they've done it. And, you know, we feed that directly back to the warfighter, and I believe we've made a big difference in that respect as well.
And, in fact, those detainees aren't there because they're Boy Scouts. They're there because they're some very, very bad people.
Exactly. You know, the goat herder, I'm a poor goat herder story, kind of gets old after the 30th or 40th detainee has used it. You know, why people all of a sudden all have to go to Afghanistan at the same time for economic improvement, you know, makes one scratch your head. Yet that's what they tell us a lot of why they've been there. But clearly, you know, they were, when they were engaged in the battlefield and taken off of that battlefield, they were engaged in some pretty nefarious activity, and it's a good thing that they are not doing so today.
And no doubt if they had the opportunity, they'd do what they...
They absolutely tell us that. I mean, they say, if you release me tomorrow, I'm going right back at it, and I'm going to find you and kill you and your family. And this is what they say to our guards, our guard force, and every other American I can find. They're pretty reticent about... you know, are unforgiving about going back and picking right back up with the jihad.
Yeah, it's too bad people. By now, you'd think they'd wake up to that.
It's a little frustrating to hear the rhetoric often spoken by people that just don't know. They just have not seen it firsthand and have not heard, what the things that we hear down there firsthand from the detainees themselves. I think it would probably change a lot of minds if they. Had a detainee with a pretty fiery look in his eye telling him that, thing that's keeping me from killing you is this steel door.
Right.
I think some folks might change their mind.
Let's go back to the, the mistreatment issue of detainees and what's been reported. You've been very open, like you said. Red Cross?
Red Cross actually is there today as I speak. They are there. They come several times a year. They have unfettered access to all my facilities, all my detainees. They get to talk to everybody. Unfortunately, they can't discuss their findings. That's part of the confidentiality that agreements that we have with them. I would love for them to be able to tell the world what they see and their impressions, but obviously we can't do that. But we have very close and cordial relationship with the ICRC, and I think we've taken a lot of their advice over the years, and it's a good relationship.
In fact, the detainees are probably receive a hell of a lot better treatment than there's no doubt about that than if the shoe was on the other foot. I mean, you respect their religion, correct?
Absolutely. Yep. They pray, get unfettered access to their religion. They pray five times a day. We sound prayer call for them. We maintain silence. All camp operations come to a halt for those 20 minutes. They get to do their prayer. We give them prayer rugs, prayer beads, prayer caps. We very conveniently paint them arrows on the deck so they can know exactly which direction to bow to Mecca. During the month of Ramadan, we alter our entire camp schedule so that they can fast during the day in accordance with their religion. We feed them at night. We just turn the entire camp schedule around just to support that. And, I think we go out of their way to accompany them. They all have Qurans if they want them.
Restricted diets?
All the meals are prepared in accordance with Halil dietary requirements. And at very high quality, they get 5,000 calories a day. Matter of fact, we actually have a growing obesity program.
5,000 calories?
5,000 calories a day. We actually, the average weight gain amongst detainees is about 20 pounds since they've been in captivity. A lot of beer guts.
Yeah. Eating a lot better than they would be in the Korngal Valley or wherever else.
Their food is prepared in the same galley where my sailors and soldiers eat out of. It's exactly the same galley, same food, same quality.
And we all know about Navy Chow, so that's...
exactly.
Yeah. Torture, mistreatment, waterboarding. You know, we keep hearing about the waterboarding. So what about that?
I can tell you that at Guantanamo, we have always conducted our interrogations in accordance with the Army Field Manual, which currently is 2-22-3. That is the guidance. Waterboarding is not a part of that. We have never done waterboarding at Guantanamo, certainly since I've been there, and I can't speak to the past, but my understanding from speaking to my predecessors is it's never been done there. You know, we are very closely bound by the Army Field Manual, and we have not deviated from that. And I feel very comfortable.
You're pretty much under a microscope.
There's no way that we could ever get away with something like that. I mean, it's plus there's no need to it. That's the most important thing. There is no need to do that because
I was just going to ask you
we get so much more valuable and important information just from having a conversation like we're having here, just to sit down. Just having a business-like, direct question and answer. And the detainees don't even have to come to the interrogation if they don't want to. They are asked to come. If they don't want to come, they don't have to come. But typically, we, you know, we'll provide a Subway sandwich or a Big Mac or, you know, some chips and salsa or some pistachio nuts that they eat, and then we just have a kind of a conversation back and forth, and the information that we glean from that sort of professional relationship is amazing. I mean, we find out some amazing things, and they're pretty open with us mostly.
Doesn't sound like a dark room with a bare light bulb swinging overhead.
No, that's all in the movies. It's just it's not a part of Guantanamo yet. That's the, you know, that's the moniker that we wear, is that you know, they've been beaten and tortured, and you know, getting information out of people that way is it's just, it's not reliable, and there's no need for it at all.
Camp 7. Come up in the news lately, and I know you're probably restricted quite a bit in what you can talk about. Tell us what you can about Camp 7.
Well, Camp 7, we acknowledge that Camp 7 exists. That is where the high-value detainees were when they were brought to Guantanamo in September 2006. That's where they were all housed. They're housed separately just because of the security involved with these people. These are the high leadership. People that had direct knowledge or participation, allegedly, in some of the most famous and heinous al-Qaeda plots, the 9/11, the coal bombing, the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, and several other acts. So these people have special knowledge, and just due to the security of what they know and where they have been, it's very necessary that they be kept separate, but in equal, I would not hesitate to say, a very same standards that the rest of the detainees are maintaining, the same high-quality food, religion, access to religion, recreation. They all get at least 2 hours a day recreation, same standards as the rest of the population, but we need to keep them separate.
They pose any danger to other detainees if they were able to?
Hard to say. I mean, this is the leaders. You know, it's as if you had a, in many cases, a place where you kept the generals and the admirals, you know, the real high leadership that, you know, depending on the circumstances, could be a bad situation to have those very high-ranking and very knowledgeable people kept where they could exert our leadership potentially on the rest of the prison population. So it's just best that they stay separate there.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, we certainly appreciate it. And if there's anything we can do for you, the many people in your command, those people you just spoke of, hey, we're here for them. So
we
you
appreciate
just let
that.
Us know.
Thank you so much. You know, it's as simple as just knowing that there are people out there that care and appreciate it, and that's all we really need to keep going. Quite frankly.
Well, I hope we're able to clear some things up today. It's been very informative. You know, hopefully one of these days the media get it right. You just keep on doing what you're doing, Admiral, and congratulations to you and your people.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to get the word out, and I will be sure to take that back to my folks back there that they're appreciated because they enjoy hearing it.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
We're standing guard with the truth, the national defense.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The Veterans of Foreign Wars believes in active allegiance to flag and country. Through legislative activism and service to our military forces, veterans, their families, and communities. Freedom starts at home. Pledge your allegiance again. If you're a veteran and served overseas, you may be eligible to become a member of the nation's elite veterans organization, the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
You've served your country, now you can help your country serve others. Call 1-888-JOIN-VFW. That's 1-888-JOIN-VFW.
In a military warehouse south of Washington, D.C., a USO stuffing party is in full swing. By the end of the day, volunteers will have stuffed over 10,000 USO care packages, packed them in boxes, loaded them on trucks, and sent them on their way to our soldiers in Iraq, Afghanistan, and military bases around the world. They'll stuff them full of things that most of us take for granted, but that our troops don't often have. Things like toiletries, playing cards, candy, books, little things. Little things that carry an enormous message to our troops. Little things like, thank you. Like, we'll never forget you. Like, we're behind you 100%. Like, we love and cherish each and every one of you. Little things. We're all about the little things. We're the USO. So are you. For more information and to find out how you can help, visit us at USO.org. The USO. Until everyone comes home.
Welcome back to National Defense. Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry. And as always, 24-Hour Fitness and our guys from there that... that can pump you up and let you down easy. And we got another one on the phone with us. This is Thomas Wells, master trainer, and, you know, not surprisingly, former Marine, Jerry.
Yeah, 24-Hour Fitness, what else do you expect? That's all. Hey, Thomas, do you have anyone working for 24-Hour Fitness that is not a former Marine?
Right.
I think there might be a few scattered here and there, yeah.
Well, and you try to weed those out as soon as possible.
You said that rather...
We do our best to filter them out at the beginning.
Yeah, there you go.
You said that rather disdainfully.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Now, you're in Santa Rosa, California.
I am. Yes.
And we talked to a guy last week, Justin Chin, who was a master trainer there in San Francisco. And what do you think? I mean, that area of California should be in pretty good shape by now, I would think.
You would think. We definitely have job security working for us.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So, hey, listen, I just like that experience of some guy that has never worked out in his life or since maybe middle school walking in and meeting you, former Marine, master trainer. That's got to open a few eyes.
It does, but it's kind of a double-edged sword. It can be a blessing and a curse because some people like the notion of having a former Marine as a trainer. They think, you know, good results, going to push me hard. Some people are very intimidated by it.
How are you?
When I first started, I came wearing the high and tight, and I had to flat out say no way when they saw me walking up to them. They wanted no part of that.
Did you drop them and... you know, drop them, squat thrust forever, or anything like that?
As much as I wanted to, I refrained.
Hey, Tom, give us an example of somebody that has come in there. And I don't know, do you work with any former Marines or any vets that come in there that just work out with you specifically?
As clients, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't have any... recent vets as clients right now. Most of the vets I've worked with recently have been more like Vietnam era.
Yeah.
But our average client is, you know, well into their 30s and up.
And what kind of, you know, everybody's individual in their, you know, what kind of paces you put them through, but I would imagine they would be glad, and that's the other thing that, you know, we're so glad to be hooked up with 24-Hour Fitness, because there is that sense of comfort there when you get one vet and you're training with another vet. So that's kind of a comfort level, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. I mean, they can definitely relate better knowing it's another vet working with them.
And there's an intimidation factor there, I'm sure, for a lot of people that aren't vets.
Well, for some, but I've actually found more people are intrigued by it than mm-hmm. turned off by it.
Yeah.
They figure they're going to be pushed, that I'm not going to accept any excuses, that that maybe I'll get them better results than somebody who hasn't had that experience.
And do you accept any excuses?
I listen to them. I let them finish saying them, but that's about it.
Hey, listen, there's a 24-hour fitness less than a mile from the studio. And I went over there naturally because we've been working with 24-hour fitness, so I thought it'd be a good opportunity for me. So I walked in
there. How was the food?
Well, I walked in there and said, I need a trainer. And, this young man came over, and when I told him that, he looked at me, he started crying. Told me,
he just looked at me and said, I'm not on duty today, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get out.
You ever get that reaction from anybody that talks?
Thankfully, I have not yet, no.
So, Tom, now, do you just train? I'm sure you train men and women. How do the women do? And we haven't asked any of the trainers about this, but I'm always curious about this. How do the women do as opposed to the men in their daily training?
On the whole, I find the women to be a little bit tougher.
Really?
It's tougher as far as more disciplined
and willing
to take on more challenges.
Right.
And they're often more open to suggestion, too. The men often kind of come in with a I-already-know-it-all attitude.
Sure. Yeah, right. I can imagine that.
I guess they think, being guys, they were supposed to have been born with it encoded in their genes, that they know how to do a dumbbell press or something. So they're often not very open to suggestion.
That's right. Yeah, I can imagine that.
So listen, the job market's kind of tough out there right now. And there's a lot of troops transitioning to civilian life who are looking for a gig, a good job with security. Say something to them about coming to work for 24-hour fitness.
I kind of lucked my way into this job, just kind of stumbled into it on a recommendation of a coworker. Hmm. That I was speaking with my last few weeks in the military, and it ended up being an absolutely perfect fit for me in quite a few ways. A lot of the characteristics you tend to inherit spending time in the military come in handy when you come to work for 24-hour fitness. It's a chance to be part of something bigger than yourself, obviously. It's a huge corporation, over 400 clubs.
Well, and you are in California, too.
I am, yes.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Well, Tom, hey, listen, thanks for talking to us, man. You've been there 6 years, master trainer, Santa Rosa, California. Just another great example of 24-hour fitness, and especially the connection that you guys have with the military. Really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. So, Jerry, some good interviews.
Yeah.
Good stuff from D.C.
Yeah, great stuff.
You got to go all the way to D.C. to get the truth.
That's right.
And hope you get the truth.
And that's all we ever do.
Good stuff.
You got to look them in the eye.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back here next week on the National Defense.
I never thought that this is where I'd settle down. I thought I'd die an old man back in my hometown. They gave me this plot of land, me and some other men, for a job.